Welcome to episode 29 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is April 15th, 2012. I'm Matthew Furlough, and this is my co-tax filing brother, James Furlough.
I didn't do it.
You didn't file your taxes yet?
Oh, no, I did that. I'm just saying, Okay. Whatever you're accusing me of, I didn't do it.
Oh, no. We're clean. Tax filing. It's tax day.
Dude, I filled mine out, back in, let me think about this, March.
Really?
And I think they said the average tax return was, 2,400 and change.
Yeah.
I managed to come in a little bit above that number. but mostly because we own a duplex and we did way too many things to it last year and incurred a significant number of expenses as a result of that, like adding new windows, painting, redoing the inside.
Nice.
No, we spent way too much money. No, so it is nice. I don't get to experience any of it other than the paint job. So I got some money back as a result of that.
Sweet. Well, hopefully by tonight we'll know what my tax returns are. I have managed to put it off till the absolute last day. Last year I was all on top of it because I wanted to do it by paper, all old school, so I could really get the experience. Yeah, and kind of understand what it was I was doing, because it was before that, I've barely paid attention to taxes before. I've been blessed to not have to. This year I was okay, well, I got this. I know what I'm doing. I'm going to fill it out online. It'll take half an hour. I can do it whenever I want. So, of course, that meant never.
Right.
So, anyway, so after the show.
So we did, we did the whole, try to do it ourselves. And then, H&R Block will do a review for you. For $40, they'll just look it over. And so, we were hey, we'll do that just to make sure that we've, done it correctly and whatever. And that was probably one of the most unfulfilling experiences of my life. he would say, why did you do this? This doesn't make any sense. And we would, or he'd be like, this looks wrong. And then we'd explain to him the situation and why we did it that way. And he'd be like, oh, okay. All right, got it. Yeah, I guess you could do that.
Oh, that's super frustrating.
And that was his to everything. And we literally got done. We made absolutely no changes. He didn't catch a single thing. And so we were like, whatever. I guess $40 to know we're fine or whatever. But
that's still super irritating.
Yeah. The next year, our lives got a little bit more complicated. And so we actually hired a tax accountant to do it for us now.
Oh, nice.
So I still don't do my own. I don't do my own taxes anymore. But
you get them done once. That's the right attitude.
Well, it's kind of like if you find the right tax accountant, which I think that we did. It's you have a conversation a couple times a year, not just the one meeting.
Right.
And we make it a point to go up to the office and spend a couple hours there on that final day. And we talk about financial strategies and what it is that we're doing and get tax advice from that standpoint. And not only that, these guys, they hang out with rich people.
Right.
People who have money and have a reason to hire a tax accountant. And so they just think about the world a little bit differently and make suggestions I have a blast every time I go up and get to talk with them because they, they think about the world differently.
Whereas I'm definitely in the place that the easy, just where I am with my, with my life and everything, the 1040 easy actually is perfect. So, and I know because I did it the long way last time.
I totally understand. Yeah, if you just got a job and a house and even if you had a couple kids, and it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
No reason to hire somebody.
Well, all this tax talk is fun, but
taxing.
But it's not the reason we came here.
What we came here
is to talk about what we always talk about. And this week, like every week, we'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera. I know you were trying to distract me. That is the soap opera that is corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and the technology they're developing. So now that we've gotten all of our tax information out of the way, I'll talk about where we work.
So one of the main reasons why I get taxed is because I work for a technology company called Hewlett-Packard. However, I do not represent HP's opinions on anything. So I should always say I think when talking about HP or whatever. And if I do happen to say we, I meant to say I.
Cool. If you want to follow us and you know get more information about what's going on in the tech universe throughout the week, you can follow the Furlough Bros. Twitter account is at Furlough Bros. You can follow me at Matthew D. Furlough. I promise not to talk about tech stuff.
I cannot make such a guarantee. but instead you will probably get pictures of my dog and wife at James Furlough.
Aw, that's so sweet. You can always go to furloughbros.com. We've got all of our information there, all of these links, all the articles we talk about, the show. You can log in through iTunes through there. It's awesome. It's a great website. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. It's everything you want it to be. And a little bit more. And you can also go on and follow us on Facebook and Google Plus, and we are going to talk about all these different things this week.
And I just wanted to add that if you guys wanted, speaking about pictures of my wife and dog, you can also follow me on Instagram under the same username, James Furlough.
Cool. What was I going to say? You can follow me on Instagram too, but...
Yeah, but you got like a private closed weird account or something.
Oh yeah, that's right. I do have that.
Because because so far my invitation is still outstanding for you. We're not even
really.
Buds. Yep.
Oh, weird. Okay, I'll have to check.
You know that.
I'll have to check into that. I take
publicly.
Pictures of fire.
Everybody.
Perfect. So it's interesting that you bring up Instagram. Make mine open since it's going to become open pretty soon here.
Yeah, really.
I suppose. Facebook did a deal this week. It showed up first on the Instagram blog, and so I'll give you a little excerpt. Facebook bought us. That's basically the expert that you get.
For how much? Does it even say how much on the...
It does not say.
That's okay, fair enough. He probably wrote this blog post using dollar bills, just, you know, literally did cutouts for each letter.
Yeah, it looks like that. All the S's have little lines going down.
And then he hired somebody to turn it into a digital blog post.
Right.
Because he could afford it.
Right. He spent all of his money on a machine, on a server that would translate it into 8 different languages and then translate it through another 8 languages back to English before it was posted, and it would be perfect. Because, you know, you can afford that kind of money when you get bought by Facebook. So how much did they get bought for?
I'm doing the math real quick here. There were 13 employees, okay?
Okay.
Each if it's an even distribution...
Which is probably not, but that's a good assumption.
Which is not, but let's just say that it is. Each employee would be worth $76.9 million.
Because it was $1 billion purchase, right, in total?
Yes. That's if you multiply that number by 13, you come up to $1 billion with the pinky in your mouth, dollars.
Okay, so this is what I find interesting about that. Just a few... weeks ago, we had the Mega Millions, $500 million jackpot.
No, wasn't it like $420 million?
Something like it was a huge amount.
Yes.
I feel like those people are going to be staring enviously at the owners of Instagram. That is ridiculous. Pretty big deal. So. I guess the first obvious question is, do you think Instagram is worth $1 billion?
So the other stat that I heard, and I actually heard this one, believe it or not, on the, it was the Daily Show with Jon Stewart, which I think I posted the video on our Facebook timeline, and other places. It's awesome, you know, as Jon Stewart is wanting to do. And he did the math where it comes out, because at the time they had about 30 million users, it comes out to about $33 per user.
Wow.
Once again, you know, doing really difficult arithmetic. Now, obviously, they didn't buy it for the number of users today, because I think they said they added like another 10 million last week just because of they opened it up to Android. And my suspicion is that they've, given all the press and everything, they're quickly going to get up to $100 million users pretty quickly. And depending on how Facebook decides to do the integration, it'll, you know, be their 800 million users within time, which, you know, is a much better number. Do I think it was worth $1 billion? Yeah, I do. I guess.
Really? Interesting.
I mean, that's a ridiculous number, but also at some level, it's just an accounting thing.
So your assumption is, I guess what my question would be is, what value do you think Facebook saw in Instagram? Because I think, yeah, I agree. I think what they saw a certain potential value that they were able to put dollars and cents to, based on how many users there are, how many users they think there will be, growth rates and everything, you know, a certain amount of money. And I'm assuming that it's because, you know, ad revenue, resonant time, their entire value is based on resonance time, how many people and how long they're staying.
By the way, that's the other important thing to add, is that Instagram had no business model, period. They weren't even talking about it. They had zero way of making money. I think that's an important thing to add to it.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, I think was YouTube. I think YouTube was in a similar situation when Google bought them for what was it, the $1.6 billion.
Well, they were
that was kind of in a. I don't know.
I think YouTube got a little. I think what happened with YouTube is they started like Instagram, and all of a sudden they became this huge thing. And their biggest issue was that they had all that copyrighted material.
Yeah.
So any business plan that they had to compensate for the fact that there was, $1 billion worth of copyrighted material that they were going to have to deal with. So it really wasn't until Google offered to buy them that there was any semblance of a valid business plan for YouTube. It was a little bit of a different situation. But, yeah, they were born out of that same, you know, and Facebook itself, you know, quite famously, you know, Zuckerberg, you know, said no ads on Facebook. We don't want ads, and we want to keep it clean. You know, to which his friend and initial investor was like, "How are we going to make money if we don't have any ads?" You know, but by keeping it ad free for an extended period of time, allowed them to build a user base, because early,
yeah, and you know, Twitter's the same way, and
right.
You know, I totally get it, but I mean, at the same time, though, there isn't one.
Right.
And I don't know. So you know, back to your original question, why did they buy them?
Right.
You know, there's lots of speculation, and you know, at the end of the day, you don't really know. But what I do know is I know these two things. Number one, Facebook is, I think they're like the number one photo repository on the web now. If they're not number one, they're going to be soon, because I'm pretty sure that they are. And that was what drove a lot of their growth. Is, you know, people submitting pictures and other people wanting to look at them and make comments and tag and blah blah blah,
right?
You know, which is cool, and fine. The other thing, so obviously, you know, Instagram kind of does photos. that's his thing, and I think the filters, you know, those are what they are, you know. But that's not the important thing. I mean, they're a cool little mix on top of them, and but that's not. They take photos. And the other thing that they are mobile. They are mobile first. As a matter of fact, they don't even really have a website.
They have their blog. That's it. They have a splash page and a blog. There's no online portal.
which is actually semi annoying when you want to share a photo with somebody, like after you've taken it. Like, let's say I took a photo and then I go back into my stream, like, oh yeah, I want to share this. You can't. This is crazy. I literally have to have at some point in time, like, shared it on Facebook or shared it on Flickr or somewhere else, go search for it on that service, and so I can find the link to the web page that I can then share with somebody.
Right.
They are mobile first, and for the most part, mobile only. Now, Facebook has publicly said, at least in their, you know, S-1 statement filing, blah, blah, blah thingy, to go IPOing, is that mobile is critically important to them. You know, that is the next space to, you know, to go, to move. And so here's this company that is doing their thing on mobile.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of like, hey, this is what we want to do, and we're not doing a great job of it at all. And so,
right.
You know, it's one of those where I think, you know, if Zuckerberg thought he could have bought it for, you know, so they just got literally, you know, valued at $500 million because they did some dealings that they had just got more money that put them at that value.
Yeah.
I think in order for Facebook to get their attention and to say yes, because I think they said this was like literally a weekend deal, he had to give them a number where they all went, whoa, okay.
Yeah.
And I think if you offer them $800 million, as crazy as it sounds, I think the founders go, yeah, we'll think about it.
Right.
I think if you offer them $1 billion with 9 zeros behind that one, they go, here, let us huddle up real quick.
Right.
And
because you're right, I mean, that's almost an insignificant amount of money when you're talking that much money, just, you know, realistically speaking. But yeah, there is a different effect that I think it has on people, because at $800 billion, you ask the question, well, you obviously think we're worth $800 billion. What does that mean we're worth? You know, whereas at $1 billion, for whatever reason, you just go, you know, I don't really care what that means we're worth. I don't, you know, there's too many, all of a sudden any risk you continue to take on your own seems foolish, even though it's, you know, it's, yeah, I see what you're saying, and I agree. I think it was just supposed to be an astounding amount of money.
Because I think you know, as a startup, you sit there and say, how do you make $1 billion? Or, you know, what are your chances of doing it? And, you know, one way is to get bought. The other way is to do an IPO. But before you can do that, you have to have some sort of revenue model in place. And I don't know if you can come up with a great one for photos. I don't think you can. You know, you're going to put ads in the photo stream? And what kind of ads do those have to be? Are you going to charge premium users? You can only upload so many photos per week? Or, you know, are you going to charge in developers to use your API? Like, what are you going to do to make money? And to make enough money to get to $1 billion or right. enough to justify an IPO, which inherently will say I'm worth $1 billion. You know, the roads to get there are difficult. And so if someone comes along and says, hey, I'll buy you for that much money, you kind of go, okay. You know, especially when they sit there and say, look, you got 13 guys and you guys are absolutely amazing. We're going to double your staff for you with other wicked awesome programmers who love Facebook and want to work for Facebook. And because I'm sure that they have dreams, hopes, and desires for what they want to do. And they're going to go, we're going to help your dreams come true.
Right.
And you go, whoa, cool. I'm in.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that I think is worth, you know, in a lot of ways is worth more than the money, you know. It's just the ability to suddenly be part of the Facebook family. So.
Yeah.
Why?
Not to mention becoming instant millionaires. That's kind of cool.
Right. Yeah. Deck of millionaires.
Because I've got to imagine, you know, some of those guys, they've got other ideas, and I'm sure that they sat there and said, yeah, if this takes off, we'll expand and we'll move. And some of them are going to go, hey, you know what, this is cool. We'll see our dream be realized over the next 5-ish years, whatever. And then they'll be ready to move on to do their next startup. And, you know, but they'll be able to do it with $10 million in the bank.
Yeah.
And that's a different feeling. And I don't know. I'm jealous. I want to go learn how to code again.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was reading it was an article that was talking about learning to code or having a technical founder. Because oftentimes with startups that you have like business guys like me who have brilliant, amazing ideas, but I can't execute on it because I don't know how to code. And so we're always on the lookout for that technical person who knows how to do it, who will magically come out of thin air. And they've done surveys and group studies and stuff like that. And their basic thing is the problem that you run up against is like that I run up against is if someone's technically sound, they're going to get offered a six-figure plus salary to work for Google or Facebook that I have to compete against.
Yeah.
Or they already have their own idea and they don't need me.
Right.
And so it's kind of like to find a technical founder is ridiculously hard. And then so one of the quotes that I heard was Dennis Crowley, C-R-O-W-L-E-Y, I think. He said, you know, for the longest time I was looking for that mythical technical founder, and finally I got fed up with it, and I learned how to code. He goes, now I'm a horrible programmer, but I learned just enough to mock up Dodgeball, which was what we needed, which is what eventually turned into Foursquare.
I believe it.
Oh, yeah, by the way, Dodgeball got bought by Google. He left and then started up his second startup, Foursquare. That was one of those, like, you know, use multiple million dollars examples.
Right. So I do have an interesting theory here.
Let me hear it.
Because I've been thinking about this, and my personal opinion is that as a photo sharing site, Instagram's actually not very cool. I use Instagram. The filters are not spectacular. The photo editing capabilities are, if I want to really edit the photo, I'm going to import it into my my photo library on my iPod Touch, edit it there, and then pop it back into Instagram, maybe add a filter or two before I publish it. But I'm not going to do photo editing. It's not the best photo editing software. Like you said, there's no real internet interface. Which, you know, as important as mobile is, I think your internet interface is just as important, because what it does is it provides instant cross-platform accessibility.
Well, it doesn't have to be crazy. I just want to see my photo stream and an easy way to share it from there.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
It.
And so this is my theory, and I think Facebook knows that. What Facebook bought was a name. They
really?
Bought. Yeah. I actually think what has happened is there is a perception that Facebook is this giant conglomerate, and I think what they fear is, or what they feel is happening, or maybe they even have studies that show that this is happening, is that the reason why people are flocking to Instagram and other similar services, or they're moving to Reddit, or they're moving to Pinterest, or the reason why they're moving to other social networks that are some specific thing, the reason why they're doing that and not integrating everything into Facebook is because they don't want to do everything on Facebook. It's like the question of why did Google videos fail where YouTube succeeded? Why did Google need to buy YouTube? Why does the YouTube name persist? I think Google is completely happy, and because you think about it, it's like Google Video had a better search engine. They had the entire Google servers,
cool.
All the major services. I mean, everything that Google Video did, it did better than YouTube. But yet YouTube got all the traffic because it was a name. It had a certain feel. It had a certain design. And I think Google wanted that. Why did Levi's, you know, why doesn't Levi make slacks? It's because Levi makes jeans, and when people walk in and they see slacks, they go, what is this? This is a Levi's. These are kids' clothes. I want professional clothes. So they go to Dockers. And what people who buy Dockers sometimes realize, but often don't realize, is that Levi started Dockers as a different brand with a different name, using the same materials and same factories that they were using to make Levi slacks. They just have a different name. And the whole idea, the whole concept behind it was, if we people won't accept our one product under this one name in this one format. They want, quote unquote, the illusion of choice. Why did McDonald's start? Why doesn't McDonald's serve burritos? Because nobody's gonna buy burritos from McDonald's. But they wanted to make burritos, so they started Chipotle. You know, and
yeah,
I think,
no, I totally get what you're saying.
And I think
they couldn't have done that though. They couldn't have homegrown something like that.
I think they could have, but I think what they did was they asked how much would it cost for us, Facebook, to homegrow something that's going to compete with Instagram, which is it's what we want. It's a mobile centric opportunity with a huge following. People are already invested in it because they're fully aware of the network effect of what happens when a network has started. And I think what they did is a calculation of how much it would cost for them to catch up and surpass Instagram. Like, how much would it cost us to catch up and surpass Foursquare in just, you know, everybody's knowledge of it and really become the dominant player and crush the other person? And they said it cost us more than $1 billion. And I went, well, I guess what we know our number is. You know, I think that that's what it came down to. I think it was, you know, I don't think it was a real, especially because of the speed at which the decision was made. I think what they realized is that they were going to lose the race, or it was going to cost them a huge amount of money to catch up if they ever caught up. And so instead, you know, before bad goes got worse and Instagram became, you know, 100 million user device, especially because it happened so soon after the launch of the Android Instagram version, I think Facebook finally decided we're not going to catch up. We better buy them now. And I think
they're going to keep... You know, at the very least, they couldn't think of a fun spin that they could put on the product to differentiate themselves, because they tried to do it with the check-ins thing. And, you know, part of their problem was they tried to do it in the Facebook app, and that was a mistake. But they didn't put any new spin on it, and it went nowhere to the point where they kind of, for all intents and purposes, canceled that and just made it so that you could tag a location to your status update, you know, which is very different. And I think that and this must have been the same way, where they were like, well, yeah, I guess we can make different filters. And, but what other spin could they put on it? And I don't think they could come up with something. And I think you get something like, you watch other examples, like Apple with Dropbox. You know, they want to buy them. Wasn't up for sale because they waited too long, you know, whatever. So Apple said, well, fine, we'll make our own. And so far, that hasn't gone anywhere, as far as I can tell. I mean, iCloud, which is different, it's that Wi-Fi sync thing. I don't remember what it's called. See, that's how popular it is. I don't think I ever even turned it on to try it, because I was like, Dropbox works. So you could try that. And then you have, like, Microsoft, right? We're like, well, we're going to make our own search engine. Okay, good luck with that. I don't think that Instagram was, like, so big that they could have been overcome. I mean, we're talking 30 million users. Okay, so what if they go up to 50 million? Really?
Well, yeah, but what you got to consider is that it was 30 million iOS users. There's only like 120 million iOS users out there. It's not like, you know, they actually have a huge percentage of the they were in a tiny market, and they've got a massive percentage of it, and we're growing rapidly. And all of a sudden they open it up to the 200 million Android, or actually, is it the other way around?
I don't know. I know what you're saying though. It's, you know, a good percentage, and
that doesn't even count to the people that, you know, since there was no online interface, they're literally, it was just iOS users, and they were a massive and growing part of that market. You know, it's an impressive thing.
Yeah, I also think that, honestly, I think Facebook needs to rethink their mobile apps and the way that they think about that entire thing, just in general. It's not. Amazing.
I think their Facebook manager or Facebook Messenger app, like a discrete app for your Facebook messages, I think was a great idea. I've used it. I've actually been very pleased with it. It's fast.
Yeah,
it's responsive.
It's all right.
And I think that that's going to be this. I actually think that that's. I don't think you're going to see Instagram integrated into the Facebook app. I think it's going to be its own separate app.
Yeah,
just like
it'll
the
be
Facebook
like YouTube.
Messenger. Right, it'll be, and it totally makes sense for them to do it that way. They're going to have a family of apps that will do your different services. And I the only thing you're going to see, and I think that this is a good idea, is that it's going to be easier for you to share and move your photos from Instagram to Facebook and from Facebook to Instagram. But
yeah, there will definitely be some cross-pollination for sure. There has to be. I mean, yeah.
What'll be interesting is what they do with somebody like me, because I have pointedly not given Instagram any of my Facebook information yet. It's only Twitter. Now Facebook knows my Twitter information because I push all my Twitter to all my tweets to Facebook. But it'll be interesting to see if they know who I am. It'd be pretty creepy.
Yeah. I don't know.
Fascinating little dealio, though.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are some people, not quite as or even more extreme than what you've talked about, where they're just like, I hate Facebook. They distrust them probably for similar reasons that we talked about last week. And so they're like, well, I'm going to quit Instagram, I guess. Go find a new one. Whoa. I guess there's already like services like Instaport that will actually export all your data so you can get it out.
Jeez. But okay. I've read a couple of articles where people were talking about their kids whining about Facebook buying it because Instagram was their own little private place away from their parents and their grandparents. Hmm. Which, it's funny, that's what Facebook was to MySpace. You know, it's Facebook was where you would go to get away from your parents back when it first started and was only for college kids. And that was the complaint when they opened it up to everybody. And I think Facebook has learned their lesson. And I actually think what's going to happen is even they'll just give you, if they're smart, I guess I should say, if they're smart, what they'll do is they'll for the longest time, they'll make Instagram feel like it's its own separate little thing. It just so happens that if you want to, you can very conveniently link to Facebook, and it all works very, very elegantly. And I think that's ideally what Facebook will do with it. And I think all the kids will barely even notice that Instagram and Facebook aren't the same.
They'll do exactly like they did with YouTube, with Google, where, you know, at first you'd be like, no change. And then, oh, you can log in and link your Google account. Cool. And then, you know, then there's a whole bunch of back end stuff going on, right? Where now all of a sudden it's all running on Google servers. And you know, and they've got Google engineers improving the back end product and making uploads faster and, you know, adding other stuff to it. And then like, oh, here's a Google Plus button on YouTube all of a sudden. You know, and oh, now it's being powered by Google's search engine and we're integrating it into our whatever that thing is called, universal search. And you know, and then finally, it's like, hey, there's some UI tweaks, and before you know it, now all of a sudden, it's even though it's still different, but it's still now it feels like a Google site,
right?
Which you know, and they took their time, slowly changed things to the point, you know, they boiled the water slowly, and I don't know, Facebook may or may not, I don't know, Facebook tends to make drastic changes and just kind of go for it and force it on everyone's throat and go like it.
I think they're learning, though. I guess that's what I'm optimistic that they're learning and that this Instagram purchase is actually the first, you know, well, I guess time will tell.
They'll do a soft rollout. Well, they will make things optional for, like, I don't know, whatever it is, 3 to 6 months, like the timeline. Right?
Yeah.
You don't have to do it. Well, they'll open up to a small group, developers, people who are invested in Facebook, and then they'll say, okay, anyone who wants it can get it, but you don't have to. It's okay.
Yeah.
And then eventually they say, once they've got enough bugs and got enough people liking it, they tell everybody else, okay, time to switch.
Yeah, their problem is that they, like you said, they do that in a 3 to 6 month period, whereas Google took, what was it, like 4 years with YouTube to make it feel like,
yeah,
and you know, and Google, all the other Google services in YouTube evolved towards the same point design wise. You know, they're, you know, to be totally frank, there are parts of Google that took on a YouTube feel over time,
you know,
and which was a good thing. I mean, YouTube had a good overall feel and design, and you know, so it's. I don't know. Hopefully, Facebook is gonna take their time and integrate it slowly and respect the fact that people got involved in not respect people, because I don't think that's why they're gonna do it, but respect what people liked about Instagram, which it's not the filters, It's the fact that it's not Facebook to a large degree, as weird as that sounds. It's, you know, and it was, you know, so they'll keep UI stuff, but at the same time, like you said, you know, the Android marketplace, that entire part of the Instagram app world is just going to explode because, you know, Google's got a huge developers team for Android. They have a real large knowledge base. They've got a great, you know, they've got their entire libraries and everything that they're doing, plus all of their back-end servers, and all of a sudden, all of that is going to power all that framework is going to power just the very front end Instagram stuff. And you know, I think Instagram is going to have a real, as an app, I think is going to have a real performance boost, which will be pretty awesome for them. So,
yeah,
I think on a whole, I'm actually excited about it. I think it was a good thing. It'll be interesting to see what Facebook does. And I think in a year or two, we'll be able to for sure make our final assessments of whether this is a good idea or not. At this point, I'm optimistic Facebook will move in the right direction. But that's where I'm at.
And a last thought that comes from Dennis Berman. I don't know who he is. But he says, remember this day. 551 day-old Instagram is worth $1 billion. 116-year-old New York Times company is worth $976 million.
Wow. Wow. $1 million isn't cool. You know what is cool? $1 billion.
A picture is worth more than 1,000 words.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Mark Zuckerberg is going to just be like, got to be rolling his eyes at that line in the Social Network movie with, you know what's cool? $1 billion. Because, you know, I think that has a lot to do with why it was sold for $1 billion. You know, billion is the new million.
It is. So believe it or not, there was actually other tech news this week.
Yeah, I got a really quick one. Somebody made an interesting observation that I think is worth bringing up, and because I think it has to do with it affects primarily Macs, but I think it'll be really powerful over the next 10 years, and you'll start to see things moving in this direction. But the article basically said you'd be stupid if you bought a Mac OS X Lion computer, so a MacBook Pro, MacBook. Or a Mac Pro without a solid-state drive. They basically said it's going to be awful. Your experience is going to be way dampened if you get Lion without that, or Mountain Lion, rather. No, it actually says Lion. but I think it becomes more powerful with Mountain Lion. And one of the reasons for it is, and it's an interesting observation, is that a lot of what Lion does, and it takes all these cues from iOS, are what they call micro input outputs, really small read writes. Whether it's like you're saving documents or you know, continually or remembering states and stuff, you know, Macs are notoriously low on RAM, and so how you make up with RAM is what you call your swap, SAWP. It's an acronym. I don't know what it stands for, but what it basically is it's hard drive space that the computer treats like RAM. So you have all this, it's long-term storage, so if your computer crashes, how it knows what was going on is because of the swap usage. This is common on in all computers, whether it's Linux, Mac, or Windows. Basically what happens is in order to keep track of all that information, also, you know, the auto-saving functions, stuff like that, in order to keep track of all that and do all those quickly and seamlessly, it needs to be doing them really, really frequently, which is something that traditional disk hard drives are terrible at.
Okay.
Because they have to build up a lot of momentum and find things, whereas with a solid-state drive, because you can just point to an address and change the information at that address electrically, not mechanically, it's really fast. And you know, it's that classic, all your programs open. Well, that's not the, you know, really fast. That's one of the side effects, but it's not the main advantage. But all of a sudden, little things like OS X getting smaller in its overall size of the operating system getting smaller, starting I think 2 generations ago. Each iteration it gets smaller. Well, it's obviously suddenly it becomes obvious that the entire reason that is because in order for it to do what they want it to do, it needs to fit on a smaller hard drive, since solid state drives currently are so much more expensive for, limited space. Basically, what their argument is that from a performance perspective, you absolutely have to have a solid state drive to get the full performance out of Lion and especially Mountain Lion. And the reason why this is important is because right now Apple's really pioneering this technology, but this is going to be a really, really big deal as app or as Windows moves into Windows 8, and they try to take on some of those similar technologies like revisions and boot times and stuff, especially for tablets.
So here's my problem. Okay, tell me how to solve this one, because I don't know how to do it. I just looked real quick. I went to the MacBook Air, the 13-inch, starting at $1,600, is 256 gigabytes, is the largest solid-state drive that you can get. And then I looked at my iMac right now, and I am currently using 264 gigabits on my iMac, which is about, 9 gigs more than what I'm allowed to have on my 13-inch. And I have a lot of songs, yes. I have only a couple movies, I think. I have a lot of audiobooks, I guess. Let me see here. How many? There's a way to figure this out. I have 22 movies on here, which a bunch of them are only like 30 minutes to an hour long type of thing. Now for books, I have a lot of books. I have 61 books. That's a lot.
But that's
Oh no, 44 audiobooks. I mean,
that's a tremendous amount of data, actually. I mean,
Okay. I mean, and I've got songs. Okay, here, let me see here. I only have like 6 gigs of songs. That's it. Oh, here, it should tell me my books. I've got 8 gigs of books, and for movies, 9.4. So that one actually is my biggest. But even still, add all that up, you still don't get to 256 very fast. So the question is, what else is taking up all this memory? I guess I do have all of our podcasts. What are our podcasts at? That's only 2 gigs of that. I don't know. Help
That's
me out
always.
here. So I've got. Okay. So let me put it this way. I do not feel like I'm have an excessive amount of stuff on my iMac right now, but yet the solid state drive is already excluded for me. What does that mean?
Well, then expect less performance from your computer.
All right.
It's one of those things where unfortunately, the real solution, the solution that Apple's going to come up with is going to be, we have the AirPort, which is a terabyte hard drive with Wi-Fi support, so you can wirelessly sync, and we have iCloud, so
Okay.
do that, which is not a great answer for a lot of people. Legitimately, if you want to take everything with you, it's not the perfect solution. The point is, I think that
So, okay,
over
all
the
right,
next.
here's the other thing. Like, most of my documents, I don't have any Furlough Bro stuff in it, but I do have all of my other documents and stuff in a Dropbox folder, which is only like 6 gigs in size. So it's not like, I don't know, I'm just having trouble coming up to 256. I wonder how you could figure that out.
There are a couple utilities that you can use that will scan your hard drive and figure out where everything is.
That'd be
I
nice to
don't,
know.
I know the ones that are used for PC, but I don't know what are used for Mac. I'm assuming they have them for Mac. Maybe they don't. But
But what you so I guess what you're saying totally makes sense.
And what you're doing.
I was actually thinking about upgrading to Mountain Lion depending on its price. So,
Yeah, it's well,
I'll
it's
probably still do it.
what they say is that if you don't if you you know if you're not used to having a solid state hard drive, you probably won't notice the difference, just because it's not like, because they're talking about Lion specifically here. They're just saying if you have a solid state hard drive, you get a tremendously improved experience, not just opening programs, but in just about everything. And you know, I think what's going to happen is over the next, especially 5 to 10 years, Apple is making such a big push. You know, they bought that one flash storage company in Israel. I mean, their thing is they are pushing expansion of the solid state hard drives, and it's all silicone. So I think over the next 5-10 years, you know, you're going to see massive improvements in solid state hard drives, like we have seen with flash drives or jump drives, rather, where, you know, that same sort of, where like 2 years later, you're like, I bought this and it cost me $50 and now I can buy it for $5. What do you, you know,
yeah.
You're going to see that same thing happen on an even greater scale with the, and so I guess it's just something to keep in mind over the next, you know, over the next few years, especially as Windows 8 comes out and you're going to see more and more improvements. That's the direction everybody's going to go, is to,
totally.
You know, where your hard drive is almost like RAM, to blur the difference between the two, really and truly. Yeah, I think it's a good move, and I think it'll be cool. The result will be awesome. But I totally should have done this story before the OS X. This is totally a bad transition. But we're gonna go back to Facebook really quick, because
and then we'll go back to Apple.
Jeez. So some researchers did some studies, and they have found a scientific, definitive, this is like direct, measurable link between the number of friends you have and socially aggressive narcissism. The more cool. friends you have, the more narcissistic you are. Which
do they have like a scale so I can see how narcissist I am? Because that would be the what I want to know.
It's the friends scale. So your how many friends do you have? We're gonna totally call you out right now.
I don't know. Let me look.
Oh, you don't know the side of your head? Weird. No.
there's a way to tell, right? Let's see. Go to my timeline. Friends. See all? I 411. Wow, I only thought it was like 250. That just kind of... I'm more popular than I thought. Man,
think about me. You have... Oh, man. That's crazy. How many... So you said 411?
Yeah.
Ha! I've got 622.
Oh, you're popular. You're a narcissist.
I know, but
okay,
all right, let's
see. Facebook provides a platform for people to self-promote by changing profile pics, blah, 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 blah. I've known some that have more than 1,000. Eh, that's not that big of a deal.
Yeah,
okay, but what I want to know, okay, this is interesting, but what I want to know is, like, you know, there's a scale here.
For narcissism?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to know, if I've got, like, more than 500 friends, how narcissist am I? And then I want examples of what that means. Do they not give those?
They don't really get into it.
That's lame.
So there's healthy narcissism, it turns out. I'm on Wikipedia now. Healthy narcissism is a mutual truthfulness of the self. Healthy narcissism is a structural truthfulness of the self, achievement of self and object consistency. Wow, this is sounds stupid. But I know what you're saying. I want to know, like, if I have, like, 500 friends, does that mean, like, I'm a terrible person? Or, like, how close to being a terrible person am I?
And what counts as a lot of friends, you know? Because I think I read somewhere that the average is, like, 240, something like that. And I thought I was around average, which is why I came up with my 250 number.
Oh, man.
But, all right. Well, I don't know.
This is so hard. Great. I didn't expect you to ask this question, or I would have done more research.
That's okay.
Yeah. So
the research revealed the higher someone scored on aspects of GE, the greater the number of friends they had on Facebook, with some amassing more than 800. So, I mean, obviously, the way that they just worded that, it means 800's a lot.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you're already three quarters of the way there.
Yeah, you're only halfway there. That's a good thing. See, grandiose exhibitionism, GE, and that's what GE stands for. Oh, man. Facebook provides a platform for people to self-promote by changing more than 1,000. That you just read that.
Average right. Number of Facebook friends. Facebook stats. Facebook.com/press. Facebook to acquire Instagram. Really? That does not help me.
I love this. I love this article. This is like from the science desk of Duh. People who score highly on the narcissistic personality inventory questionnaire had more friends on Facebook, tagged themselves more often, and updated their news feeds more regularly. Like, honestly, that's supposed to be a surprise to me. I guess it's good when you like in science when you have obvious results and they have, you know, and the results meet your like expectations. Like, that's important, I guess. Really? I wonder how much they spent on this. But yeah, so and I guess what it is to say is that all of you people who thought that your friends with like 700 or 800 or 1,000 friends that update what they eat all the time and are tagged in like 7 billion different pictures, yes, those friends of yours are narcissistic. You know, but you probably already knew that. So.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah. Good times.
So, let's go back to Apple.
Okay.
For half a second.
Okay.
Because we cannot coordinate. I would even closely look through the list, but whatever.
I have a feeling that this is going to happen a few times.
So, D10 is coming up. It's the All Things Digital Conference, D.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I love watching their videos. I will admit to wasting many of hours watching their Q&A stuff. I mean, it's pretty awesome where Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg, they literally get on stage with the, you know, with the big tech wigs and just grill them. Was it last year or was it 2 years ago? I don't remember, but they had like Mark Zuckerberg up there for one time, and yeah. And it was awesome. He like was sweating and totally nervous. It must have been 2 years ago because Steve Jobs did the keynote that year.
Right.
And I mean, and that was, and the keynote is basically like an hour long interview, not just him up there talking,
right.
Maybe an hour and a half long interview. And probably one of the best interviews ever.
Right.
Even if you're not a Steve, that was where he did his trucks and cars and bicycles analogy.
Yeah, it's literally one of the most quoted interviews of the last few years.
I mean, yeah,
it's insane how, you know, people paid attention.
They just released the iPad, and yeah, it was awesome. And then like the year before that, they had both Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, or maybe that was the same year. I don't remember.
I think it was the year before, but that's where you get all those awesome comics about them, of the two of them joking about being rich.
Yeah, or like they're smiling. There's that one screen where they're smiling at each other and they're like talking about how much they hate each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, so it's an awesome, awesome conference. I would love to get to go sometime. But it's pretty cool. So this year, D10, they are bringing Tim Cook to do the opening, you know, keynote. It's not keynote, interview, I guess.
Yeah.
So this will be pretty interesting because this is his first. I mean, he went to that. He went to something different earlier this year, but it was kind of like a closed door type of deal, and
yeah.
And we could just read about the responses. But this will be like his first get up there, do an interview. They get to ask him all sorts of questions for, you know, however long it'll last. And he kind of gets to just talk about his philosophy behind Apple and technology and where the world's going. So being that he is the leader of the largest company in the world.
Yeah. Should be significant.
should be good listening to.
Right.
I'm looking forward to it. And it is happening. Oh, did they give a date? No, of course not. Why would they?
Right.
It's happening when it happens. If you're in the tech, you'll know it.
Yeah, if you're listening to the show, I'm sure we'll discuss it.
May 29th.
Oh, that's soon. Nice.
So, yeah, so it's coming up.
Cool. So, all right, man.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. But also something pretty darn awesome and earth-shattering. I was reading this on Ars Technica. Spaceship X is the spaceship company that is owned by Elon Musk, who also owns Tesla. And
I drive by the Tesla factory every day.
I think you tell me that every time I mention them.
Duly noted.
So those that guy, his company, Spaceship X, has has filed a notice of intent with the FAA indicating that it wants to conduct an environmental impact study for the construction of a new spaceport in Cameron County, Texas, on the Gulf and very near the northern border of Mexico. The site could make Texas a powerhouse in commercial space.
Oh, so okay, when you say spaceport, I immediately think sci-fi, which means space station where people go to port. Obviously, Cameron, Texas is not in space. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so basically, from what I could read, is that right now if they want to launch a spaceship, they have to literally like rent the launch platform from NASA,
right? In,
like, or Cape Canaveral, Russia. Or right. Russia, and so they that is a complicated process, from what I understand.
Yeah, and, I believe it.
And they are literally planning on doing like 12 to 20 launches a year. I know it's a minimum of 12 launches a year. Wow. And it's 12. And oh, with two Falcon Heavy launches, whatever those guys are.
I have no idea.
Probably payloads up to the International Space Station. But the point is, they're planning on doing a whole bunch of launches. Yeah. And that's one a month, right? I mean, that's a lot. And basically, what they've come down to saying is, we want to own everything. We just want to run it ourselves, make it totally private, have control over it, so that we can do it on our own time horizons, on our schedule, so we don't have to rent, we don't have to work with the government, we don't have to get involved in all the red tape and blah, blah, blah. We don't have to compete with other people. We could just do our own thing. They could probably keep things private or secret if they wanted to, a whole lot easier. You know, there's a whole bunch of advantages. Obviously, the one big disadvantage is that they have to build it and maintain it, and that is probably not cheap. But theoretically, they're getting paid in some capacity for these 12 launches, so that'll help fund it.
It's to me, it's amazing that you know, they obviously have a good enough business plan that somebody's going to loan them the money to go and do this. Like this, you know, that to me is encouraging in and of itself, that there's enough reason to go into space that they think that they can charge their way to a successful business model here, you know, and maybe it's less expensive to have a launch pad than you, because it sounds like they're just building a launch pad.
Well, it sounds like they also they're a lot closer to where they to their testing facility, and I mean, there's, you know, they sit there and say there's a lot of advantages around it, but dude, that's pretty crazy. I mean, this is like they're doing an environmental impact study, right? This is like we're proposing to make a proposal.
Right.
Is kind of the stage that they're at. But even just to be there, dude, that's pretty awesome.
That is pretty awesome. Wow. That's exciting.
Yeah, so that's when spaceport is really their own launch platform. But hey, if you're going to do it, call it a spaceport.
Really. You know, really and truly, makes sense to me. cool. Very awesome. So speaking of new things, a dude decided he wanted to start his own ISP, Internet Service Provider. Basically, this guy is his name is Nicholas Merrill, and he's planning to revolutionize online privacy with a concept as simple as it is ingenious. A telecommunications provider designed from its inception to shield its customers from surveillance.
Cool.
Basically, he wants to make an internet service provider, and it sounds like a wireless ISP, more importantly.
It has to be, because that's the future.
Right. That is dedicated to the privacy of the individual users to the extent that they're going to encrypt everything to like crazy levels, and they're not going to have their own encryption keys for it, which means it'll encrypt on your device and they won't be able to read it when it comes through their servers. Like all the data that we have, theoretically, you know, if you're using a wireless ISP like Verizon or AT&T, they can theoretically read everything that's going through and process it because they have all, it's not encrypted to them. But you know, the idea here is that not only do they want to be able to not only will he be standing up against the FBI and the and your other major internet you know, major organizations, whether it be Homeland Security or whatever, they want, not only is he going to say, no, you can't look, he's going to say, we can't look either.
Wow.
Which is a pretty pretty courageous thing to do. You know, and NSA is actually one of the biggest ones that use that go to data. Because I don't know if you've been hearing the news, but the AT&T and Verizon have basically been selling tracking information and data to
Awesome.
national. Yeah, I mean, and it's there's a the ACLU has had a has done a couple of I guess press stuff where they've been talking about investigating what police departments around the country are doing, and basically they'll go to AT&T and say, and in many cases without a warrant, and they'll ask, you know, we want to know where this person is. And they claim that they generally use it for finding missing persons that are in danger, but there's no governance overview of what it is. There's no warrant needed, so it's pretty terrifying how bad it could be abused. And AT&T and Verizon, it got, I don't have the numbers unfortunately, but it got published earlier this week what they charge for that sort of a service, and it's not unreasonable. And the other question is it's like, what, you know, if you don't need a warrant for it, what's to stop AT&T from selling that information to a husband who suspects his wife of cheating? You know, there's all sorts of crazy, kind of scary stuff that's going on from your privacy. And basically what his argument is that, you know, the major ISPs today aren't respecting your privacy in any way. This ISP, it will be run by a nonprofit called Calyx Institute. That's Calyx. I don't know if I pronounced it right, but that is what it is. And it's but the Calyx Institute is a nonprofit, and the ISP will be a nonprofit. So the whole thing will be done at cost, or that's what the goal is. They say that their goal is to have it's going to be the WiMAX, the 4G WiMAX broadband, is what they're looking to do, which means that it'll only work in big cities where that's sort of already taken root. But obviously, this is a way to get into the market, hopefully get some energy, and then, you know, maybe move to you know, buying time from AT&T and Verizon like T-Mobile and Sprint do, you know, if not eventually becoming a big enough player to actually be able to build your own towers, you know, but most you know, like I said, T-Mobile and Verizon, and a lot of your like mobile PCS, a lot of your smaller telecoms don't have a lot of their own towers. They just piggyback off of the other two big networks. So hypothetically, they could go there, but this is the really exciting part about the whole thing. Ideally, their data, unlimited data, would be $20 a month. But this is the trick, and I think this is a brilliant
How do they
move.
do that?
It's prepaid for a full year, so instead of paying month to month, you pay, you know, you'll pay 1400 or yeah, 1400.
24
Holy cow! Wow, numbers.
two
$2,400.
times 12 plus a zero.
You know, you'll pay $2,400 ahead of time, which is, you know, which is sizable. But I think what they'll do is, number one, that will limit the number of people that are
Where'd you
gonna
get
buy.
$2,400 from?
What? $240?
There we go.
Whoa, that sounded awfully high, man. I'm an engineer.
No calculators were harmed in the making of this math.
Seriously. Wow. Wow.
Anyway, I didn't mean to distract. Point there.
So, but basically, I think it's brilliant because what it'll do is it'll put a bunch of money in their hands that they can use to give them a guaranteed user base. And I think there's a lot of compelling reasons. Yeah. There's a lot of compelling reasons to go that route.
Anytime you can get money up front, life is good.
Right, exactly. And I think what will end up happening is that the people who are using it will, you know, who they'll, number one, they won't feel like they're getting ripped off. And number two, I think you're going to get a particular type of clientele, which are people who value the privacy within, you know, large cities. And I think that's going to be a large number of people. So I don't know. I think it's really exciting. I don't think necessarily you're going to see this come up as a third-party ISP that's going to be a huge player, in 10 years and going to be one of the big guys. Although I think they'll stay around for a while, but what I do think they'll do is that they'll definitely put a lot of pressure on your biggest wireless ISPs, whether it be Verizon or AT&T or T-Mobile or Sprint. And what you're going to start to see is the movement in the direction of more value towards security, better encryption, and that sort of thing. And hopefully, I think, for society as a whole, you'll have an improved, better of a... you'll have an improved level of security for everybody all around. So,
yeah,
I like it. I'm pretty excited about it, and I think that it's a good step in the right direction.
Huh. Cool. So, speaking of steps in a new direction, have you seen the new Google Plus interface?
I have not. I'm going to do it right now. I've been putting this off just so you can actually... Oh, man, I put it in wrong. It's plus.google.com.
I bet if you do google.com/plus, it would work.
Whoa. Look at this. Whoa, okay, stuff's popping up all over the place. Uh-oh, it's going to start talking to me really soon here. Continue to Google Plus. I don't want to know anything. Very cool. So it's got all my... Nice. Profile. I like this.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, look at that. Oh, my gosh, the cover photo. It totally ripped off Facebook. That's hilarious. I haven't said this yet.
Cover photo?
Yeah, that big banner on top of your Facebook profile, where you can put a big picture. It's in landscape. I think that was actually a really brilliant move on Facebook, just from a design perspective. I think it really has prettied up Facebook and given your site a little more a touch of you for each individual thing. I think that's actually been a really good move, and I think at least all of my friends have done a good job picking photos that aren't ugly.
I like mine.
Yeah. I can't remember what yours is. What's yours? Oh, that's not... Jeez.
It's the stash.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That is a good one. That is a good one. But... Cool. I'm glad they stole that little UI thing. It's a good one.
Yeah, so they got the buttons going down the side. If your browser is wide enough, the chat actually is on the right-hand side, just open. If it's skinny, it goes down to the bottom, out of your way.
So I guess they decided that they liked what Facebook was doing. Jeez.
Yeah.
Holy cow. Now that I'm actually looking at it functionally, the setup is Facebook. That's weird. I don't you know, if you can't innovate, steal, I guess. Google would probably be so mad to hear that right now. We did innovate. Look at this. We did this differently. We don't have blue.
We don't have blue. We have gray.
Right. Oh, jeez.
Yeah. No, it's cool. Whatever. I mean,
it looks nice. And I think there's something to be said to standard interfaces. It makes it, I think it allows users to move when you're trailing, I think there's something definitely powerful behind taking cues from the leader, and you know, integrating that way so that people feel comfortable moving towards you. You know, and every company that's been behind has, in one way or another, you know, eventually accepted the standards of the more dominant company. So
hey, you know, if it works, it works.
Exactly.
Makes sense.
If it ain't broke.
Yeah, so they unveiled the new Google Plus. Check it out.
Nice. Cool. So now this one's a little bit, technically it's Apple, but on Wednesday, the Department of Justice took a break from everything else they were doing and sued Apple.
Yeah.
Bum, bum, bum. I think they're going to win hands down if they don't settle out of court. Open and closed.
Well, let's be clear. They didn't just sue Apple. They sued everybody. who is involved in the publishing world.
In all fairness, they went on it's a big antitrust lawsuit. It's collusion is the word.
That's what they're alleging.
It's what they're alleging. Essentially, what happened was, Amazon was selling ebooks for about $9.99 online. It was going great. Kindle was, you know, $9.99. Everybody was happy. Apple decided to start iBooks. They went to the publishers and said, "We'd like to move from what we call the retail model to the agency model." And what that meant was, instead of the retailers setting the price, whether that be Barnes Nobles or Amazon or Face or Apple, because they were becoming a retailer, we want the agencies to set the price. So your Macmillan books, your
which is currently how the App Store works.
Right, they set the price, so it made sense. And then what Apple and the book publishers are claiming is that nobody said anything beyond that, but all the publishers decided that they wanted to raise the prices to the exact same price in every single retailer, whether it be Barnes and Nobles or Amazon. So Amazon got livid because
so the way that Amazon set up was, is they were buying books from publishers. Or the rights to distribute them, whatever, for, you know, $12, $10, whatever it was. And then Amazon could set the price at whatever they wanted. And the publishers got paid that amount. And so then Amazon was selling them for, you know, supposedly at a loss at $9.99, you know, because they'd buy them for $10 or something, and they should have been selling them for $13, but instead they were selling them for a penny less. And as a result, these book publishers were like, "Well, great, we can't sell our books anywhere else now, because we can't compete with Amazon, because we need to make money." And, you know, ostensibly they were, but they weren't super happy with it because they were stuck. And so that once they, quote, made this deal with Apple, or, you know, basically there was another player involved, they were able to go back to Amazon and say, "Hey, we want the agency model," and essentially were able to force Amazon to do it.
Right.
So that's kind of...
And the real problem is, the real hang-up is not the agency model versus the versus that or necessarily even, you know, strong-arming Amazon to change their model. What the real issue is that they all magically came up with the exact same price for books. And that's where the price fixing comes in, because now what's happening is all of these companies that are supposed to be competing against each other, ideally, are acting as though they're one company when it comes to setting their price, thereby reducing competition amongst the publishers and distributors. And
very illegal.
And the end result for us, the buyers, is that we pay more for books than we should. Now, the question I'm going to ask is, how much does it cost to make a book? Because this is something that I'm really curious about. Because I, you know, as an aspiring author, I've done some writing and I'm looking into getting published. I've talked to quite a few authors, and I know that the amount of money that a author gets is not a lot. It's a very small percentage. It's pennies. Oftentimes for an initial book, coming back out in hardback, a new author will literally get 75 cents of the $25 book, which is,
wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then it's the reason why so many authors are turning to self-publishing. So, but you know, the big publishing houses still have a very compelling argument in that, well, they have the distributorship, they have the ability to get your book on the shelves in Barnes & Nobles, because they will front the money to get those books printed so that they'll, and then give them to Amazon. They have the networks, they have the ability, they have all the editors. So that, you know, it's not like they're doing it for free, but from an author's perspective, they don't get and even big time authors only get a few dollars for a hardback book. It's not a really great deal, all in all. And the reason why this is significant to me is because I really want to know where all this money is going. You know, $15 for a digital copy, you know, it costs $10 to make a book? Is that what the case is? You know, I probably will never know these things, but I hope that people will write in the future to try to kind of get to the bottom of, was Amazon right? Well, you know, is $9.99 a fair price for what it costs to produce a book? Is it a
fair... Right, and let's be clear. I mean, you're talking about the first book, because
right.
The second book is pretty darn cheap.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you know, in
well, and I mean, production. and you gotta think about, like, you know, Amazon, or not Amazon, Microsoft charges a significant amount of money for their software, and they have the same thing, right? Where right. I mean, even if it's a digital, whatever, you know, it doesn't cost much, which is why you see their margins are unbelievably awesome,
right?
You know, as a company, and and books, digital books, have got to be that same way, pretty good. But, yeah. You know, to get that first book and to do the marketing, to get the word out, that all costs money.
Yeah, you know, and I guess I actually, if I'm honest with myself, that would be interesting to know, but I guess it's sort of a moot point, because really and truly, if a company's willing to spend a tremendous amount of money to get only good authors, and then they charge more for all their books, and so their books are very expensive because of this, that, and that, have nothing to do with manufacturing costs, then okay, you know, because those things will directly affect the cost of the digital copy. They should be able to charge more for the books. I suppose, you know, like, realistically, that is how I feel. So, you know, the real problem becomes, it's like,
plus if it's a valuable book, I mean, it's the you're right. paying for value, not it's, the production of it.
Yeah, it's right. But it's the non-competitive nature of what happens in the market, and I think what you're going to find, you know, I think what's going to happen is a lot of publishers are going to settle outside of court. It sounds like at least Apple and Macmillan Publishing are going to go, you know, going to take it to the wall with the DOJ. So it, you know, we should hear this in court, but I have a suspicion that the government's going to win this one. It just seems to me that just because of the, you know, it will be pretty stunning to find out that every book costs the same amount for every publisher to
Well, and I would want to see, like, the timeline of book prices. Was it literally right. day one they were all exactly the same, or did it take 2 weeks?
Or, right.
You know, because if it took 2 weeks, then it's like, no, it all happened that fast, where right. one person saw it, and who knows, it might have been Macmillan, who went, dude, we put ours out there day one. This was our price. We never changed it. Why would you think there was collusion? Or maybe they took them 2 weeks, and then they went, well, geez, you know, if everyone else had their price up, let's raise ours. Why not?
Right.
You know, I could see that. And I could see Apple just being like, dude, we didn't do anything. I mean, yeah. Sure, we talked theoretically that you can get higher prices, and yeah, we put numbers out there, but we weren't like telling everybody to set your prices here. That's not what it is. But you also know, like, for iOS games, you're like, 99 cents is a pretty good price. You're not right. going to want to charge more than $5. That's not it. But then when you get to the iPad, no, like $10, that's a reasonable price to charge for something.
It's right.
And for whatever on the Mac store, it could be $20. That's okay. You know, that's not You know, so like there are definitely price tiers there. I don't know. We'll see what happens. I like to see lower prices as a consumer. That's my choice. That's my vote.
Right. Yeah, me too. And I guess that's what we really want to see is that you want to see the consumer get protected, but Amazon is clearly not happy about it. So hopefully hopefully we'll see something move in the right direction. It would just be nice to see Amazon be able to, be able to sell books for cheaper. the real issue though is that it's, I guess what you will find though is because, at least because you can have a Kindle app on pretty much any device anywhere, there's a certain amount of you expect all books to be similar price. So maybe that's what we'll find is that they'll make the argument and successfully that. We didn't have to do this ahead of time because this is just naturally what happens in this type of market. When everything is fungible, everything becomes the same price, wherever that price is set, whatever the comfortable price is, and everybody just meets that, and there's no real competition. That just seems ridiculous. It seems ridiculous that nobody would try to sell their books for $14.50. That to me is where that's where the argument breaks down. Like, why, especially...
I come back to it where it's like, well, books are different, right? If you've got a New York Times bestseller, now you just want to maximize the price and because you don't care. So, and if your book's $14.50 versus another one that's $14.99, they're not even looking at the other book because they're not deciding, especially on an online thing. They're not on a bookshelf comparing two books, deciding, oh, which one do I want to get? Which one do I want to buy? They're reading the reviews and they're reading the summary of it and then deciding to buy it. And if it's the same price as everything else, they're like, I don't care, I'm buying a book. And now you're competing on content, not price. Right. It makes sense. Maybe. You would only catch eyes if you sold it for like half the price. This is $7. Then all of a sudden people go, oh, okay, wonder what's up with that. And even then you have to say it's on sale. You can't just set that at the price.
Right. That's a good point. Okay.
I read a really cool article that you got me on this. It was about app pricing, and they were talking about what this person did, and she said that she had like a regular version and a deluxe version of her app.
Yeah.
And she said like the deluxe version gave you a bunch more features. She was like, it was pretty cool. And the regular version, it was fine. It worked too. You could be just totally happy with it. It just didn't have a bunch of these other features and stuff on it. And so what she did was she said two price points. One was for like, I don't remember anymore. It was like for the deluxe one was like $10 and the regular one was like $5, something like that. And then she discounted both of them. She said she put the regular one at $3 and the deluxe one at $5.
Yeah.
Okay. And she went, and what happened was, so it was like, it was on sale, even though it was never offered at the regular price.
Right.
And the difference between the regular and the deluxe was now only $2 instead of half the price.
Right.
And she said she sold a bunch. She said it was like 70% of it was the deluxe version.
Weird.
And it was because, well, most people who were going to buy it, they go, for $2 I get all these other features, and it's on sale, done.
Right, and it was always on sale. That's hilarious.
Yeah, and so that was, they'd be like, oh, man, it's for the same price as the regular one was. That's amazing. And so, it was this total, like, pricing and psychology game thing. So no real takeaway there, just interesting.
Yeah, really. Yeah, interesting. That is very interesting. So, speaking of pricing psychology, turns out Microsoft...
By the way, I'm going to actually stop you before you get into that. Check your Hangout real quick to make sure you're not asleep, because both of mine gave the sleep notice.
Oh, thank you.
If you don't have it...
because we keep getting cut off in the middle of the show. Thank you.
So, keep your eye on that if it hasn't done it yet.
I just we woke it up, so we're good.
Cool. All right.
Nokia and Microsoft are not having a good week.
Come on, guys! You're supposed to be number two or three in the.
I know. Market. They pulled a PlayStation 3 You have your big debut phone. They're going to be giving this to all the AT&T employees. AT&T employees are going to have to recommend this to customers.
They get to recommend it.
Yeah, right. Sure. Over the iPhone, it's a big deal. It's a great phone. It's the real. It's the It is the flagship of the Nokia Microsoft partnership.
Yeah. It looks like a cool phone.
It does. It looks like a very few cool phone. And then there was a bug right out the gate. So basically what they find is that the phone is having problems staying connected to data. So there's really intermittent data issues.
Oh, that's a big bug.
It's a fixable bug. It's not a hardware issue. They're working on a patch, but this isn't Apple, guys. You can't sell a phone that all you have to do is hold it wrong and then the data will completely disconnect. people will stop buying.
Dude, I like this one line in the third paragraph. Though still the world's biggest volume maker of cell phones. That's not true.
Really?
They got passed by Samsung later in the week.
Oh, really? That's hilarious. I didn't know that. Yeah, I mean, this is Nokia's just... Oh, that right, because this is the next article I was going to talk about. Oh. Nokia cuts forecasts on handset competition. I guess it was the same day, but it led to that. Their shares have just plummeted. So between the Lumia not doing very well, selling poorly, bad forecasts for the next quarter. Nokia's in a pretty big... I know. These guys are not doing well. And unfortunately, I don't think this is good news for Microsoft either. I don't think it's as bad a news for Microsoft.
That's pretty bad.
Well, it's... I always go back to... I think... To me, the PlayStation 3 was a very revealing device. You had a device that had a lot of potential. It really stumbled bad out of the gate with some poor titles, some big bugs. They didn't hold their own against their major competition in one form or another. And then over the long term, the platform has succeeded. They fixed it up. They cleaned it up. They changed. They got some better titles. And I think what's going to happen with what you're going to see continually, especially as they kind of unify their user interface across their entire universe, what you're going to see is a real usefulness and you're going to see what happens with Apple, where you buy your first Apple device, and now it makes sense to buy another Apple device because you get these benefits. And then as soon as you have a computer and an iPhone and an iPad, I might as well get AirPort and Apple TV too. And pretty soon all you own is Apple stuff. I think that's the direction that Microsoft is moving.
Yeah, and they're great at iterating on something and making it better over time.
Exactly. And so I think that Microsoft is going in the right direction. I don't know if they'll ever pass Android or Apple, but I don't think it's a doom for them. But this was a really big one for Nokia. This could be a really, really, really big problem because it just is a,
Well, come on. I mean, you can't sit there and say Microsoft will be fine and Nokia is going to die. I mean, that kind of... They go together.
But other people can manufacture Windows phones.
Yeah, but they're not.
Okay.
And they're not going to until this Nokia partnership works out. That's my opinion. There's no reason for them to invest the time and energy. I mean, yeah. Because if there's demand for it, they're going to get it from Nokia.
Right.
I don't know.
That's true.
I think they'll be fine. I mean, yeah, this isn't fun, but they just got to keep a multiple year outlook and not worry about this right now.
Right. This is a minor stumbling. It's a minor issue, but it's a pretty bad misstep. and in the long run, Microsoft can always buy BlackBerry. BlackBerry's figured out how to manufacture their own phones.
That'd be a mistake and a half.
I think so. I would not recommend it if I were in the position to recommend such things. So.
Oh, you are.
But, yeah. So, yeah, that was our weekly rim bashing.
Something to sneak that one in there.
Yeah.
I like it. Hey, did you know that Barnes & Noble's still around?
I did. You know, I bought a book from them earlier this week.
Nice, nice. Was it an e-book?
It was not an e-book.
Because if it was an e-book, you could read it on their new Nook Simple Touch with glow light.
Oh.
$139. So wow, they actually have an e-book right now, which I believe is $99. So this one's a little bit more expensive. But what it has is glow light. This is actually, so it uses e-ink, okay?
Okay.
But then it also has a soft, now it does, the screen has a soft glowing light. So wherever there isn't black, it will have a glow. So it's not like a light bulb, like in your face. It's not like the iPad where it's like, woo, this is bright. It's like soft glow. Have I made that clear yet? Soft glow.
I'm sure that they really want to emphasize that, so I'm sure they appreciate this.
Yeah, well, because the idea is you can read it in bed and not wake up your partner, and you don't have to use an external light. Because what a lot of people do is they have these, like, they'll have, like, a Kindle or a Nook, and then they'll have a case with a light on it that just makes it bulky. And this totally gets rid of it. Now, here's what's cool is they have also been able to improve their battery life. So for their $99 Nook, it had a battery life of 1 month.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah, pretty good. I think the Kindle's somewhere around the same range there. I mean, I believe so. It's good. This one, if you, even with the light on during regular usage, it has a battery life of 1 month.
Wow.
And if you turn off the battery or turn off the light, it has a battery life of 2 months.
Holy cow.
I think that means you have to turn off Wi-Fi, but there's really no reason why you would have it on other than to download books. So,
yeah. That's compelling. If you're in the market for a e-ink e-book reader, which why? I think that this is a really compelling device.
Well, it's cool because you can still be outside and you can read, and it has the natural feel to it, whatever, which studies have shown it's more pleasing to the eye. And even this low light, they've said, is more pleasing to the eye than, say, like the iPad light at night. And so kind of tries to do the best of both worlds there.
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting, it's actually a clever idea, and it's a cool piece of technology. I just, you know, and maybe this is just me. I just don't have any interest in something like that. That just seems like such a limited case use for me. And I read a lot. It just still seems like, man, I don't know.
Well, my biggest problem is that Amazon keeps figuring out ways to give me credit. And so I have all this Amazon credit. I kid you not, I have like $150 in Amazon credit right now.
Whoa.
And I know, I'm pathetic. I just know how to grow money is what happens.
I know, and I hate it so much.
So like, for example, I recently bought a Kindle book because I was like, well, I'm not going to spend money to get an iBook. I'm gonna get a Kindle book. Duh. I'm going to use my credit. And so that was what I did. And
the Kindle app is so universal that it's like,
And how much do you want to bet? How much do you want to bet by the end of the year, Amazon has some other, you know, glow light equivalent?
I absolutely would not take that bet because if they don't have it by the end of the year, that's pathetic.
Other than that, I don't know when their normal launch window is, but...
Right, yeah, that's a good point.
Whatever that is. Their next round.
If this is a compelling device and people are buying it because, obviously this is what people have been asking for.
I like it, yeah.
You know, I don't think that this is the sort of thing that all of a sudden somebody had a brilliant light bulb idea and went, you know what would be really cool that I don't think anybody's ever thought of before? A lit screen. that's not how that went. I'm pretty sure people have been asking for something akin to this for a long time. Could I get a really dim light that I can use in the dark that would allow me, that would still be easy to on the eyes, but would be wouldn't increase the bulk or increase the battery life or decrease the battery life? And, you know, they finally found a solution. And, you know, a big part of the solution is that it's a dim light, you know. It doesn't require a lot, you know, to power it. So I think it's a, you know, I think it's a very...
it's very cool.
Yeah. No, definitely. It's a, from a technological perspective, it makes a lot of sense to me. And if that's what you're in the market for, I think it's a good... That's a good device, but you have the problem of it being a Nook and not a Kindle, you know, and which means if you want to port those books around, you can't, and that to me is a real real flaw, a chink in the armor, as it were.
Yeah.
So.
But so
speaking of Amazon, moving into their movie realm, did you know that Amazon has over 17,000 movies and television shows for you to watch?
Wow.
That's pretty huge, isn't it? I mean, that is a lot of TV and movies to watch. Turns out it's that might be a little bit of a gross overestimation, because what they did was they counted each individual episode of a TV show as a television or movie.
Oh, tricky.
Yeah, and so they...
Yes, I see it. Television shows, not television series. I see it.
Right, yeah. When you realize, like, oh, okay. So it turns out they only have 1,745 movies, which is a tenth of the figure that they came up with, and then 150 TV series, which is, you know, not nearly as impressive as 17,000. This is the one that got me, though. They started going through different TV shows, so it's like Amazon, or so for The X-Files has over 200 episodes. Grey's Anatomy, there's over 170
Sweet.
Episodes. Yeah, which is, you know, okay, that's pretty bad, but this is the one I love. Power Rangers.
Yeah.
All their different iterations. Mighty Morphin, Dino Thunder, Space Patrol, Delta.
Uh-huh.
There's 715 episodes of the Power Rangers, which makes up 4.2% of the 17,000 movies.
Power Rangers.
Yeah, which I
that's
don't
awesome.
I don't think that's what you're expecting when you hear that they have 17,000 movies and television shows. So,
dude, I just give me more of that Green Ranger, we'll be good.
Oh, heck yeah. So, I think it's funny. I mean, it's just one of those, you know, the Power Ranger one is what got me.
It was classic, like, okay, we gotta talk about this. What happened was they had some marketing genius, which I will use that, you know, satirically, who, yeah, they went for the biggest number they could possibly get because they wanted to boast, like you said, and didn't even kind of think through the implications of that and went, no, it's technically true, and just went
right,
with it.
Right, yeah. And it's like some – it's like they went to some tech guy and they say, how many files do we have in this folder? And they went, 17,000. Like, okay, that's how many TV movies we have, which is just like, that's, no, it doesn't work that way. So, unfortunately, this article didn't, let me read this.
Well, I see it says Netflix technically says they have like 60,000 streaming
right.
titles. But they don't boast about it. That's just, you know, they will say we have thousands of titles available.
Right. But yeah, so when you compare it, it's, you know, it just doesn't, you know, it's not an apples to apples comparison, and Amazon got a little bit of a verbal lashing from the media this week for maybe being a little too pompous. So, I don't know. There's still a lot of TV shows, and they say it's a good
internet.
So, I know. So, but
yeah,
invest
it's a,
in your
it's a lot. iTunes still is more.
Oh my gosh, they just inked a deal like yesterday with Universal.
Yeah, so, I think
to move said, stuff to iCloud. So big day,
cool.
Yeah.
So this next one is not actually tech news, other than it's Nintendo, and they're awesome, so we talk about them. And it's sad that they're not doing amazing right now, because yeah. I love Nintendo, but, you know.
But how is Nintendo not technically tech news?
Well, what I'm about to say is okay. not tech news. It actually has to do with game design.
Okay.
Or game level design. They
we talked about Tax Day for 5 minutes at the beginning of the show. I think they'll put up with a little bit of level design about Mario.
Yeah. Probably. So, Gama Sutra, or Gama Sutra, probably, they interviewed, what's his name? I probably cannot even say it. Koichi Hayashida. He's the director of Super Mario Land, or Super Mario 3D Land, and Super Mario Galaxy 2.
Nice.
And, and so they were like, he talks about how do you create engaging level design. And basically, so I just think this is fascinating. That's why I'm sharing it.
Yeah.
It's not actually news. But what he says is the first thing you have to do when creating a level is you have to create some sort of core concept. Whatever that is, right? He's on a lake.
Right.
There's a pirate ship, and he's got to get this star from the pirate ship.
Right.
Whatever is going on in the galaxy at the time. Which is cool. And so you have that, okay? He goes, and then what you have is some sort of new, and part of that that concept, too, is some new game mechanic that you're teaching them how to do.
Right.
I don't know, blasting out of a cannon, for example. So he goes, first thing you have to do is you have to learn how to use that mechanic, okay? And so... And then throughout the stage, it will offer you slightly more complicated scenarios in which you have to use it. Okay?
Right.
You know, classic, right? That's, you're learning a new skill, and so we're just going to keep moving you along, making you get better and better at, like, aiming the cannon, something like that.
Right.
And then the next step is something crazy happens that makes you think about it in a way you weren't expecting. And then you get – and so he goes, and that's where the magic happens, is where you thought you were learning how to aim a cannon to, like, to attach to, like, catch poles and hop over walls or whatever. And then there's some sort of twist where you go, oh, I actually need to use this. I don't have a great example because I'm making this up on the fly. But it's like, oh, I actually need to use this to, like, to fly, to catch something. You know, it's not about, or I need it, like, I'm a bullet. I'm not. Right. It's not a transportation device. It's a bullet device.
Well, yeah. Well, the idea that I remember early. I mean, this is Mario 64. You know, at first you use the cannon, and we go with the cannon. But the first world in Mario 64, the first time you use the cannon, it's literally just to get you from one part of the map to the other part of the map quickly.
Yeah.
Get you up on the hill quickly. But very quickly you realize once you've kind of gotten good at getting places using the cannon, all of a sudden the next time you go in, you realize, well, there's a bunch of coins that I have to aim at the coins and hit the coins to win the level.
And then you get the winged hat, and now all of a sudden it's a launching device. It's not
right
to travel. So stuff like that. And then he goes, and then finally what you do is you demonstrate your mastery over whatever that skill is. To
that's
defeat the boss.
Part of the game that I always had a hard time with.
But so he was saying that it's this like this four part series where you get introduced to it, you get a little more complicated to learn how to use it. There's some sort of twist on it, and then you have to demonstrate your mastery of it. It's like this four step process to game level design, and. Anyone who's ever played a Mario game knows that that's awesome.
Yeah.
And it works. I think most games work that way, or most good games work that way.
I bought Portal over the weekend. I've played a couple of
That's a
Portal,
great example.
Portal 2, rather, which is a... I have not laughed so much at a TV show or... movie or video game probably since I started watching, like the first time I watched Community. So, it's been a year. As I have not laughed as hard as I have at this game. It's hysterical and terrifying. But that being said, the level design is brilliant. For that reason, it's a physics puzzle essentially, and they have to, you know, you have to think with portals is the tagline of the, now you're thinking with portals, it's the tagline, and they you know, this Portal 2 really bumps it up a notch, because now you're not just moving around, but you're also, they're including, you know, changing the direction of beam particles, like whether they're bridges or lasers or whatever, mm-hmm. and using them to shoot enemies and stuff. So it's a, you know, it's really cool, and it's I can definitely see where they're going with that, where, yeah, because I mean, an example I would use is that there's a bridge, it's a laser bridge you can walk on, and you use it for a while, and then all of a sudden there you see you come into a level and the bridge is tilted sideways, so you can't walk on it. You're like, what am I supposed to do with a tilted bridge? And all of a sudden you realize you can use it as a wall against the targeting drones. That's cool. I'll have to pay attention to that now now that you've brought it up to me. It's sort of like the, how do you tell what's going to happen to a character later on in the movie? Imagine what the worst possible thing that could happen to them is, and that's probably it. You know, just be as mean as you can, and that makes a compelling character. So, cool.
I hate that.
I know.
Yeah, thought you would like that.
Cool. Well, I do. Real quick update. We talked about it last week. Apple has released the fix for the flashback Trojan. So, you know, once again, get on that. Make the world a better place.
I downloaded it. I don't know if it did anything, but I downloaded it. I feel better now.
You're protected. So.
Yay.
Woo-hoo.
Though I did, it was like right after our podcast. I might even have been processing the podcast. I did have like a Adobe Flash update come in.
Yeah.
And I did it, and then it was like, we need your username and password to install it. And I went, do I do this? I can't remember. I know it's Java related, but I think I remember something about Flash being involved. Cancel.
Yeah. Probably was a good move.
Yeah, so I was like, well. Oh, well.
Yeah.
So, I haven't checked my wife's computer yet, but next time I update her computer for her, because she doesn't do it herself, I'll be installing it. So cool. The last thing I wanted to talk about, we'll see how fast we can do this. There's no happy ending. I'm going to give it to you now. Okay? Sorry. And the title of it is The 5 Most Overhyped Future of TV Topics.
Uh-oh.
So, unfortunately... he doesn't tell you what he actually thinks the future of TV is going to be. So that's the sad part.
Oh, that's frustrating.
I know. He just tells you what it won't be, or at least what's not interesting. Okay. So,
right.
Or what's overhyped, I guess, is the best, you know, is the way that he put it. So number one, the future of TV is about voice controls and gestures.
Okay, you're going to have to describe this to me, because my initial reaction on that one is, what does he mean by the future of TVs? Because I think he's incredibly wrong if he doesn't think we're going to be not going to be talking to and gesturing at our devices.
Well, so the one thing that he does say, so he gives an example. In the future, you'll tell your TV to change the channel to 702. Ask it when the next Tom Cruise movie is on, and wave your hand to change the channel. Really? This is exciting? And then he goes, when it comes to gestures, basically looks like, except for video games, it makes no sense. And
compared to voice, a really, really effective voice control versus gestures, yeah, I'm with him on that.
So, and well, in his thing in, okay, let me, I don't want to jump the gun here. Yeah, we're good. His thing was, he goes, basically, forget about voice controls. Your second screen is going to be your remote, and it's going to be infinitely better than voice controls. Screen being your iPhone, iPad, where you'll be able to search, you'll be able to flip through channels, see previews, read summaries, read ratings, and then say, yes, this is the one, click, you know, watch, and then the TV will just flip to that new one.
Those aren't mutually exclusive.
Okay, fine. But he's just saying, if you have that, you don't need voice controls.
I think he's wrong.
Well, okay.
Yeah, okay. Sorry.
He's also going to sit there and say, it's not that revolutionary, not that amazing. Quit talking about it. This is
okay.
All right.
That's fair. You can say that it's not as exciting as you think it is.
The future of TV is all about social TV.
Okay.
So he says, literally every big show event these days has a follow-up about how it's the most gigantic moment in history of social TV ever. You know, he was like, you know, Game of Thrones was it. But before that was American Idol, and American Idol will probably beat it again, and then the Olympics will beat it, and then it'll be the Super Bowl. You know, so he's like, big deal. Why do we care about this? And, you know, and his whole thing was like checking in, saying I'm watching this. He's like, that's so last year, no big deal. And he's like, and what's the value of measuring real-time tweets anyways? And so he's like talking about there is something about this engagement with TV. But he's like, that's really this nebulous idea and concept that's really just starting to form.
Okay, so this is my first thought is going to be, ever since the advent of the DVR, I think for anybody with a DVR, the idea of watching a TV show when it airs is patently insane.
Totally true.
Like, nobody does. So, okay, if his argument is that because of the ability to watch TV on demand, all TV on demand, the whole idea of everybody watching at the same time is minimized, then yeah, I can agree with that statement. The only thing about that is that despite the fact that the DVR obviously makes, you know, everybody watching at the same time less important, DVR has been around for, what is it, like 10 years now? And it's been a big deal for 5 years. It's been a commonplace for 5 years, which means that despite the DVR being commonplace, American Idol, Game of Thrones, and all your other big things are still beating. You know, you think about Friends back in the 90s. Everybody sat down and watched Friends at the same time. Or you think MASH is even a better example. Like, half of the nation sat down and watched the show together, and the next day they would all talk about it. I mean, and that doesn't exist anymore, yet despite that necessity, despite the fact that you don't need to be sitting there when it airs its first time, people still do it. And I don't know if that's just a vestiges of the past or if it has to do with being there first or what exactly that means, but I do know that opening weekend reviews and opening weekend people going to movies opening weekend is huge for the movie industry. Your opening weekend can make and break a big blockbuster. You know, and so if your entire goal, because if you have a huge opening weekend and the movie is terrible, you still do all right. But if you have a small opening weekend, but there's really a lot of chatter about it, that can make the movie as well. You know, the worst case scenario is to not have very many people there and not have very much chatter. And so I think, especially because movies are so expensive, I think it's becoming extremely important for the movie industry to get a ton of people there and get them talking about it and saying good things if it's a good movie right out the gate. Because it can save a movie that gets slow out of the gate. And it
okay,
can make
so
a movie
for movies,
that's
great, but TV?
I think with TV it's similar, especially because it's on demand, like movies.
Okay.
You know? Let
me read you number three, because it's saying the future of TV is about cord cutters, which is this idea of not on demand. Or I should say not, how do I want to say it? You know, that is video on demand, right? Using things like the Roku and saying cable's dead and, you know, Apple TVs and Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Instant Movies, you know, all those things. And basically he's like, honestly, there's absolutely zero proof so far that has been any even remotely disruptive. If anything, the cable numbers continue to grow each year. And, you know, so clearly cord cutting is not happening or not at a rate that is meaningful and significant. So all that to say,
that's interesting.
Yeah, DVRs, yeah, they exist. And maybe that's probably not in this category because that requires cable.
Right.
You know, his whole thing was like, honestly, it's $80 a month. That's still a pretty good price point, you know, to pay for constant entertainment.
Well, so if your argument is that people aren't moving to entertainment on demand, and they are sitting down and watching the shows when they air, doesn't it become even more important to have a social aspect of it? And maybe people won't be that excited about it, but from the perspective of the cable providers and you know, basically anybody in entertainment, they really, 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 really want people to get involved, and they're willing to bend over backwards to get people involved, because that increases the number of people that are going to watch it over time. You know, especially,
yeah, maybe.
I don't know. That's an interesting, I feel like those are conflicting perspectives. Oh.
Well, which is why he's like, and both of them are probably wrong to some degree. Or, you know, these are overhyped things, right?
That's okay. Just,
once again, okay. You know, he's not.
No, yeah. to say they're overhyped is fair. Okay.
and he is in some case saying it's not going to happen to both of them. Okay, so how about this one? The future of TV is all about apps. Just imagine a world where installing a browser, where instead of browser channels or searching for things, you can download apps for it all. ABC app, NBC app, Fox app, Bravo, which might be part of the NBC app, TBS, Sci-Fi, which might be the same, like similar to Bravo. How about an app for Seinfeld? Woohoo! You know, that might have its own app, or it might be part of the TBC, or it could be a part of the NBC app, or some mix of them. And he goes, "This is the future, and it's awesome. If awesome means terrible." And then goes on. You know, and basically his thing is like, yeah, apps sound cool, but that's an awful lot of work than just channel surfing.
You know, if the app model were going to work, you'd see it in YouTube. You know, you'd see YouTube moving that direction, but you don't. I think OmniSearch is the future of browsing,
yeah,
and
totally.
Organization. You know, and I think talking to your device is
gonna give me some favorites. You know, right. So you know, hey, these are my top 20. But
you know, and you can categorize stuff as I want ABC, but it's still going to be those will all be tags, and you'll just do some sort of a. You'll have one search bar where you'll say, I want ABC shows, or I want Bravo shows, or I want Seinfeld, or I want science fiction, or I want Doctor Who episode 34, you know, season 17, whatever, you know.
Yeah. And then his last one is, which is probably the reason why it's fifth, because it's not as good. The future of TV is the death of the television industry as we know it.
Yeah, that's probably not true. I can agree with him on this one.
You know, which he goes, it's something that's ripe for disruption. He goes, but they said the exact same thing when we invented VCRs and then DVDs. Right. He's like, but the way that the current industry is set up, where most of the what are those guys called? Most of the distribution people are also the content creator and production people. It's like, you know, because they're not split up, they control everything.
Right.
And so...
And they've done that on purpose.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, so it's like, so it's different than music in that regard, because music, you definitely have your musicians, and then you have a distribution channel, which are the stores, you know, that the CDs used to be in and stuff like that. And those were separate things. And this is not the case.
Right.
You know, which is interesting. And so he's like, it's not going anywhere. Stop talking about it. Which, I mean, part of it too is, you know, it requires a huge budget to make some of these things, and you can't, and the internet favors a bunch of small independent things, a la YouTube, and that's just, you're not going to have anything cool, and people want something cool, so you're going to keep them big.
And I guess my point, and the argument I would make is, we talked about this a lot last week, and so I'll just briefly recall it, but it's, you know, the idea that the TV industry didn't hurt the movie industry, it helped the movie industry.
Yep.
Because, you know, and I think, I actually do think the TV industry is ripe for disruption, but just because their model is disrupted doesn't mean the companies are going to go away. I think quite a few of the companies are going to change with it and get better with it. And, you know, and other companies will rise up. You know, it's like, you know, Apple disrupted the smartphone industry. That doesn't mean that nobody makes smartphones anymore. It just means, you know, it means that they actually gave Motorola and Samsung an opportunity to become huge players in smartphones.
Yeah.
Whereas the old kings, you know, collapsed and but they're still all smartphone companies. And that's, that I think is what you're going to see happen, As TV on demand continues to move forward. I guess what my argument in all of this would be is like, yeah, he might have picked a few specific technologies, but the idea of TV on demand, I think, is going to continue to grow. Debundling, you know, your cable providers, I think, is also going to continue to is a selling idea. And I think smart TVs is also a really, you know, compelling argument. I don't think your monitor on the wall model, where it's just a you sling stuff to it, necessarily is the only option. And I guess it also comes down to, I think, you know, talking to your devices makes a lot of sense if it can understand what you're saying and it can use that information intelligently. And if that's the case, then yeah, I'd rather talk to my TV than you know, play around with my iPhone, to be totally honest. And since that's kind of the gauge that I use to judge all type of technology, that's my feeling. I think he's wrong on the idea that, that TVs won't change dramatically with improvements in gesture and voice recognition. But, okay. You know, that's just
fair
my
enough.
Opinion.
It's like fair enough.
Man. Yeah. Cool.
Cool. So that was it.
All right. We got through that pretty fast.
Yeah, that wasn't bad. One of our longer shows for sure, but it was an interesting week.
Yeah, it was. It was a good week.
There's a lot going on. For sure.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but...
So is there anything in your life you want to talk about really quick going on?
You know, man, I had something before the show started, and now I can't remember it, so it must not have been that important.
Nice. Well, nice.
So, literally nothing.
You're going to feel awful when you realize what it was and you didn't mention it.
It wasn't that cool.
I mentioned mine already. I got Portal 2, and it's pretty fantastic. I was debating between Skyrim and Portal. Skyrim costs $60, and they say there's like 300 hours worth of content.
Wow, yeah.
Portal 2 costs $20, and they say there's about 16 hours worth of content. And I sat there and went, well, 16 hours sounds like way more time than I can invest, so I won't spend three times as much for something that I'll probably only get, you know, 1% of my gaming experience out of.
So wait a second. Do you have an Xbox?
No. You can buy both games through Steam for your PC, which is...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I did not... I'll talk about it next week.
Okay.
I forgot an article, and it just came back now.
Well, it's too late, man. We are... The train is past.
That's why I said next week.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, I don't think there's anything exciting going on in my life right now. I'll have to make that different next week or something. I finally want to learn how to code stuff again, but now it's a matter of getting the motivation to do it.
All right, man.
Which is always a trick. It's the crazy part of life for me at work right now. It's kind of weird.
Right.
But yeah, cool. Awesome. Everyone, thank you for joining us. I am James Furlow, and my tax brother? My brother in taxes? there we are. You know, that guy. He is Matthew Furlow, and we will talk next time.
Oh, I'll wait to
what?
Oh, you're making noise with your mic right as I started.
Got it. Go ahead.